Anatomy and Physiology, the Brain and Cranial Nerves, Part 2. This slide here I just threw in again just to remind you the big picture. Last time we did most of the cerebrum, but all we got up to was about right here. We just finished the lobes of the cerebrum. So we're still on the cerebrum is my main point by showing you this slide. So let's march on down this list and we should get all the way through the brainstem in this particular unit. I love this next structure called the basal nuclei. Here we have a picture of one of those transparent brains and you're looking into the brain with x-ray goggles from the right side, and mostly this green stuff you're seeing is some of the what we call the basal nuclei. In English, these are three lumps of gray matter located deep within the cerebral hemispheres. And I want to give you another definition for nuclei if I haven't already. A nucleus, I know in A&P 1, you learned early on that is a part of a cell. But in neuroanatomy, a nucleus also means a lump of nerve cell bodies that has a common purpose. So let's talk about these. The basal nuclei, yes, they have connections with and communicate with other parts of the cerebral cortex and other parts of the brain, but that's not the main thing on this slide. The main thing is their function. The basal nuclei help regulate basic automatic subconscious muscle movement and tone. In other words, this is one of the parts of the brain that helps you while you're sitting in your chair maintain your muscle tone. You're not thinking about it. It's just basically automatically happening. How about when I walk across the room? I'm not thinking, you know, flex right arm, bend right knee, bend right toe. I mean, it's just happening on cruise control. Another example is laughing. When I tell jokes in class and students laugh, that's a basic automatic subconscious movement. It's just happening. And the students who don't laugh, by the way, I think they need an MRI scan of their basal nuclei. So how do I remember it? Basal nuclei help regulate basic automatic muscle movements. What happens if something damages the basal nuclei? Well, we lose that control. I'll give you an example. Parkinson's disease. The basal nuclei is one of the areas of the brain implicated in Parkinson's disease. So if it's damaged, they lose control of basic movements. So what happens? They start to have a tremor. Another example is Tourette syndrome. In Tourette syndrome, which you can look up, they lose control of muscle movements as well. And the basal nuclei have been implicated in Tourette's syndrome. So what do? Sometimes drugs don't work for either Parkinson's disease or for Tourette syndrome. And there's this fascinating procedure you should probably look up called the deep brain stimulation, or DBS. And what they do is they thread electrodes through the bony skull deep into the brain and they insert them into the area of the basal nuclei. And then they hook that up to sort of a battery pack and or pacemaker kind of a combination. The theory is if they get those electrodes into the cells in the basal nuclei that maybe are still working properly, and then you jack them up with a little bit of electricity, maybe you can get the few remaining brain cells in this part of the brain working better and maybe overcome the deficiency. And there's cool videos out on the internet where they actually show the surgery being done and somebody maybe playing a violin and initially tremoring, then when they put the electrodes in and turn up the electricity, the patient then all of a sudden sort of steadies out and loses the tremor. The same thing with Parkinson's disease patients. This next slide just shows a frontal section through the brain. to try to give you maybe a better 3D perspective on where the basal nuclei are. And I sort of have arrows to them, these three bluish lumps located on both sides, of course, deep within the cerebrum, are lumps of gray matter that have this common mission. Then we move on to the limbic system. This is the last part of the cerebrum, the last part of the big brain that we're going to talk about. This is a sagittal section of the brain, and most of the parts of the limbic system are seen from this medial view, and most of them are in a greenish color on this slide. The limbic system is one of my favorite parts of the brain. It is also known as the emotional brain. Yes, emotions like pleasure, pain, anger, fear, affection, etc., all regulated in part by the limbic system. Also note what else is tied into the limbic system. Smell and memory with a star. I want you to write down right now that if I or anybody else ever asks you where your memory banks are or where your memories are stored, you're going to say, number one, the association areas that we just talked about, and number two, within the limbic system. Let's stop on this point and just talk for 1 minute about smells and memories and how they're tightly tied together. I bet everyone right now could think of a smell, maybe a cologne or a perfume, and it will evoke certain emotions, won't it, and certain memories. I could think of smelling my grandma's cooking, and just by that smell, I can picture the kitchen. I see her. I can see the food, and it's just amazing to me how tightly interwound our emotions and smells and memories are tied together. Well, on this slide, there's about 8 billion parts of the limbic system. The good news is for you, I'm only picking out my favorite four ones that all have little red stars or lines under them. So the parts I want you to know from my course are, number one, the limbic lobe. The limbic lobe are basically some kind of noodles and other structures in this general area that I'm tracing. So hopefully, if I have a question on the test to pick off parts of the limbic system, you'll pick the limbic lobe. That should be a no-brainer, so to speak. The next part of the limbic system I want you to know is the olfactory bulb, shown right there. Probably see them in the brain lab shortly if you haven't already. The olfactory bulbs, of course, are part of our smell pathway, aren't they? The third part I want you to know of the limbic system are called the mammillary bodies of the hypothalamus, shown here as a little red nugget. And you may have seen them in lab, but I bet they didn't tell you what they did. The mammillary bodies are also part of our smell pathway. And the way I remember this is, on this picture at least, it looks like a little red nugget, and that always reminds me of Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer. So I just picture Rudolph's red nose kind of dangling down here as the mammillary bodies, and that's the way I remember the mammillary bodies help us with our sense of smell. And I want to stop right there and give you an example again of how tightly intertwined our smells are with our emotions. I want to tell you a story about college. It was some friends of mine. It wasn't me. I wasn't involved in any way, nor do I condone this behavior. But these four guys were roommates, and one of the guys was going out for the evening, and they kind of knew that he was probably going to go out and maybe have a good time and maybe overdo it a little bit. So the three guys, the three roommates left, thought what would be funny in the small apartment they all shared was to get their what they called their air poppers out. In the old days, I don't even know if they make them anymore, to make popcorn, they had these things called air poppers. Essentially, you dumped popcorn kernels into a tube, and the hot air heated it up and then shot the popped corn out through a chute. So about three of these guys got together, got their air poppers, and over a period of about 4 hours, just kept letting the air poppers pop and basically filled the apartment living room, which was small, but filled it up about 1 foot deep with popcorn. Then when the last roommate came home late at night after he had overdone it, the overwhelming smell of the popcorn just got to him and he got ill all over the place. And then the funny thing, I guess, was anytime he came into the apartment complex, if anybody was cooking popcorn, that little whiff of the smell of popcorn immediately made him get ill. So that's a story that shows you how intertwined our sense of smell is with our emotions. The last part of the limbic system I want you to know is called the amygdala, spelled right up here. I love the amygdala. Right down next to the amygdala, let's consider this maybe to be the anger and rage center of the brain. How do they know that? And I think your book, at least in one of the versions of the book, has this. In the old days, the way they figured out what parts of the brain did like the amygdala kind of went like this. They took a cat. They threaded a small electrode through the thin skull of the cat. They threaded it right down to the amygdala, which is located right here. They threaded it down to the amygdala, and then they ran electricity through it. And what the cat did was instantly went into that Halloween kind of a pose. The back arched up, the hairs raised up, the tail went up, the cat hissed and spit. And so that's how they kind of found out what the amygdala did. That reminds me of a true story. My wife, she likes cats. I don't like cats. And so, of course, we have two cats. One of the cats, he's an older cat. He's good old, just nice, mellow kind of a lap cat. But the other cat, she's just a mess. So one day, what I did, unknown to my wife, is at home I have a cryo probe. A cryo probe is a thin metal probe that when you turn it on makes a little ice ball at the tip so you can freeze things like warts and stuff and skin tags. So I threaded that cryo probe through a small incision in the skull. It's easy to do. Thread it right down the middle. I found the amygdala and I froze it. And now that cat is like the most mellow cat of all time. No, I didn't really do that. Some of you are thinking, yeah, he did that. No, I didn't do that. I don't know what you think of me. Of course I didn't do that. Please don't tell anybody I did that. That is not true. But I was thinking about it. I'll give you another example of the amygdala. I love the amygdala. You know, normally there might be a young mother you might know as a calm, cool, collected mother. Maybe she takes her 2-year-old or whatever to the playground, puts him or her in the swing, then maybe turns her back for a couple minutes to talk to a friend. And then when she turns around, she sees a stranger approaching her youngster. And all of a sudden, the mother kind of goes into this rage and just rages on the stranger. That's an example of the amygdala kicking into full gear. Okay, I think we stressed enough how strongly emotions are related to memories. I'll give one more example. It's called PTSD. That's post-traumatic stress disorder, commonly seen in our brave soldiers in the military. They experience things that many of us can never imagine. Maybe they're in a foxhole with one of their buddies, and one minute they're fine, next minute something devastating happens to their best friend that many of us would never even want to imagine. And those soldiers who come home then have this disorder called post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the thoughts behind post-traumatic stress disorder is that at the time that that event is happening, our adrenaline, right, is really high in our system. And they think that somehow biochemically, adrenaline compounds drive those memories deep inside our memory banks, and it's really hard for them to get it out. Let's leave the cerebrum and now move on to the diencephalon. Remember, this is the part that goes through the middle of the brain. It extends from where we left off, which was the cerebrum, to where we'll go next, the brain stem. So I'll circle it. There it is. Notice that the parts include the thalamus, the epithalamus, and the hypothalamus. all of them have the root word thalamus in it, so maybe know that to pick that off correctly in a multiple choice situation. Let's look at the three pieces, one at a time, in that order, of course. The thalamus. Let's look at your book picture first. This is one of those transparent brains. You're looking into the brain with X-ray vision from the right side. And here is the thalamus. Here's another view. And then they take the thalamus and suck it out of the head and blow it up really big. So what are these puppies? These are paired oval masses mostly made of gray matter. In other words, mostly nerve cell bodies. They look like two big lumps. As a matter of fact, they are big. They make up the majority of the diencephalon, if I ask you on a test. And these two ovals, they sandwich in between one of our ventricles called the third ventricle. Remember the midline slit-like third ventricle? Well, it's squashed between these two ovals. That, to me, look like eggs. I mean, they really do look like a couple of eggs in your head. And when Mama said you were an egghead, well, I guess she was right looking at this picture. And my mama called me an egghead one day, and I said, no, Mom, I'm a thalamus head. And you know what I got. So that was for being a smart aleck. The two halves of the thalamus are usually joined by a bridge of gray matter that many of you will cut in the lab called the intermediate mass. Just so it turns out, just for fun, that about one-third of people are born without the intermediate mass, and it turns out they're okay. We really don't need it. It has no major function. But the thalamus, the eggs, they are key, because I want you to know that the thalamus, it is the major, with triple stars, relay station for sensory impulses that go to the cerebral cortex from the spinal cord and from the brainstem. Almost any sense you could think of has to pass through the eggs, has to go through the thalamus before it makes it up to our melon for interpretation. Now, I said it was major sensory relay station, but I want you to know it also has some motor function, okay? How does the thalamus communicate with the cerebral cortex? Through a thick band of white myelinated axons with a star on it that you must know is called the internal capsule. I'll show it to you, I think, better on the next slide. Here's a frontal section of the brain. Here in red is the thalamus. Again, it looks like two hard-boiled eggs to me. And here are very faint on the picture, but I'm tracing over these wires. These are the thousands of white myelinated axons that go from the thalamus to the cortex, or from the eggs to the noodles for interpretation. I don't know why we use food examples in anatomy, but we do. So between the eggs and the noodles, we have the internal capsule. And one of the reasons I stress this is there's a poor blood supply to the internal capsule, and it's not uncommon on an MRI scan on your patient to come back and say, Mr. Jones has a small stroke of the internal capsule. And they may have sensory dysfunction, of course, or motor dysfunction, because remember, there is both. Very common to have little strokes involving the internal capsule. Mark my words, you'll see that on the chart. The epithalamus is another part of the diencephalon. The root word might help you with location. Epi means on top of, and it is physically a little bit superior, I guess, to the thalamus. The only part of the epithalamus I want you to know is a small gland shown here called the pineal gland. The pineal gland is a gland that makes a hormone called melatonin. Melatonin is thought to promote sleepiness and contribute to our biological clock. It's a hormone that's made during darkness that makes us feel sleepy. So when we sense darkness, melatonin gets produced and makes us feel mellow, and we hopefully fall asleep. What happens, by the way, as we age? do we make more and more of this or less of this? I bet you know in your elderly patients, they make less melatonin. And elderly patients tend to have a harder time falling to sleep. And so what do? Well, sometimes they go to the drugstore and they buy melatonin supplements. You can read about that. It's a little bit controversial, actually. But in any case, the thought is there. I'll give you another example of the importance of melatonin. There's a disorder called SAD. SAD is not how you feel when you get a bad grade on the test. SAD stands for seasonal affective disorder. What is it, and where do you see it? Usually you see it in the states up north, especially Alaska, where they have many months out of the year where there's not a lot of sunlight. So what happens during those months of darkness? Well, the pineal gland thinks it's bedtime, so it makes melatonin. And it's making too much melatonin maybe all day long, so you kind of feel mellow, too mellow, maybe a little bit depressed during the daylight. And that's what happens. That's what SAD is. So what's the therapy? It's not rocket science. If you see a patient with SAD and you make that diagnosis, the treatment is, you guessed it, light therapy. Supposedly there's this special light bulb they can buy that's supposed to mimic the spectrum of the rays of the sun, and that makes them feel better. Here's a picture that I think much better shows the pineal gland, kind of like, I hope you see it in lab, the sagittal section, medial view of the brain. Here is the pineal gland right there. Usually has a little darker color to it like it's shown in this picture. So there it is if you want to see the pineal gland. The last part of the diencephalon I want to talk about is my favorite part of the brain. Bang for the buck, this is the most powerful part of the human body. I think you'll believe me and agree with me by the time we're done with it. It's called the hypothalamus. Let the name help you. Hypo means below, and it is inferior to the thalamus. Here's the thalamus here with a cut through the intermediate mass, and then below it is the hypothalamus. It contains many nuclei. What does that mean? You got to know it. It's big picture stuff. It means it has many little lumps, little nuggets of nerve cell bodies clustered together that have a common mission. So all these little jelly beans that make up the hypothalamus, they each have a name and they each have a function. The good news is we're going to cut to the short story, the important story, which is on this slide. You need to know the four main functions of the hypothalamus. Number one, this is the area where hormones, chemicals are produced that control the entire endocrine system. I know in grade school they told you the pituitary gland was the master gland. Well, it's not. They messed you up in high school. The hypothalamus is the master of the pituitary gland. It is really the master gland. And hormones, we'll learn when we get there, control everything in the human body down to the nitty-gritty of metabolic processes. Then the hypothalamus also regulates smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. So what should roll off the tip of your tongue is the hypothalamus controls the all-important autonomic nervous system. If that's not enough, and look, that's almost everything. Hormones, autonomic nervous system, I mean, that's like everything. If that's not enough, feel like I'm doing an infomercial, right? It slices, it dices, it chops. If that's not enough, it also regulates a constant normal internal environment for our body by regulating fluid balance, thirst, hunger, temperature, sugar. In other words, it regulates homeostasis with the star. How powerful is this tiny part of the brain? And if that's not enough, it also is one of the parts of the body that helps regulate our emotions. So how do I remember it? Because lots to remember in A and P. Well, I put it up this way here on purpose. Look, H-A-H, like ha ha ha. Well, no ha 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 at the hypothalamus. I know it's small, but don't laugh at it because it is all powerful. No ha ha ha, no laughing at the hypothalamus. That helps me remember H for hormones, A for autonomic, H for homeostasis, and then my laughing or not laughing reminds me that it regulates emotions. Now comes the brainstem. This is the last major part of the brain we're going to talk about. It is located between the diencephalon and the spinal cord, and the three major parts in order are midbrain, pons, and medulla. What's inside the brain stem? This is a big picture general principle for the whole central nervous system. We kind of did it in the spinal cord. We're going to do it in the brain here in the brain stem. In general, what's inside here? White matter arranged in functional groups, axons collected together that have a common mission called tracts. And then we also have gray matter lumped together in functional groups. In other words, collections of nerve cell bodies that have a common mission, and those are called nuclei. So when we break down the brainstem for each part, I'll pick out a couple of tracts, a couple of nuclei. We'll learn their names, and we'll learn their mission. Here's an overview gross anatomy slide again. This is important to look at, especially if you studying the sheep brain in lab, because it's important to know the orientation of the brain stem. It is located or oriented essentially vertically. Here's the midbrain, here's the pons, here's the medulla, from superior to inferior. In the sheep, it looked like it was going horizontal, didn't it? But we walk and talk different than a sheep. So our brain stem is oriented different than a sheep. It's vertically oriented. Never forget that. That will help you on all the directional questions you may ever see, and it will help you in real life. So, usually in class what I do is I stand up facing the class. Let's say the class is out here. I face the class. I pretend that I'm a brain stem. My midbrain I picture as my head. So my brain is the midbrain. And then the pons, I just imagine my potbelly pons. So I have a potbelly pons that does kind of stick out. And then the medulla are my legs as I face the class. Furthermore, to help me remember the anatomy and all the directions, I have a cerebellum hanging off me. So kind of right behind my potbelly pons, I have a cerebellar backpack hanging off of me. And it's a great way to remember. Corny, but a great way to remember all the directional anatomy you need to know. This is a drawing if you don't like the gross anatomy. Again, same deal. Brainstem oriented vertically, midbrain, potbelly pons, medulla, and then you got your cerebellar backpack hanging off. I want to go back to this other gross anatomy picture for just a second. You're going to see a lot of trauma victims, gunshot wounds, knife wounds, and so forth. And it's important to understand the vertical orientation of the brainstem. Give you an example. I've seen people that were shot, stabbed, maybe nail gun injuries that kind of went right here through, up and down through the frontal lobe and maybe through the front of their face. And although they may have had significant damage, they usually live through the injury. However, if a knife or gunshot wound went this way and went through the brain stem, well, that, of course, could be a life-threatening injury, because we'll learn there's a lot of what we call vital centers inside the brain stem. Let's start with the midbrain. All these directional things coming up on these slides, you should be able to get down with my visual, but let's touch on a couple things. Here's the midbrain on this drawing. The midbrain begins from where we just left off, the diencephalon, and it ends at the pons. So here is the midbrain in a mid-sagittal section. What your book does, though, and what you have to understand to get all these slides right coming up next, is on the picture, your book takes a knife, makes a cross section through the midbrain right here, and then it turns it towards you end on so you can look at the cross section and all the pieces within. But what you have to remember in the process of cutting it and turning it towards you, what's the orientation here? in true anatomical position. This is actually the posterior part of the brainstem, and this is the anterior part of the brainstem looking at you. Let's take a look at some of the pieces. Number one, a very conspicuous structure, this little tunnel in a cross-section of a midbrain. This tunnel that runs through the center of the midbrain is the cerebral aqueduct. Yeah, that's the brainwater duct passing through the midbrain that we already talked about that connects the third ventricle with the fourth ventricle. Here's a bigger blow up of the cross section of the midbrain. And again, please remember, this is posterior, this is anterior. I've only picked four parts of the midbrain to look at, so just calm down. We'll look at them one at a time in this order. We'll first look at the tectum, followed by the cerebral peduncles, then the reticular formation, and finally the substantia nigra. Let's start with the tectum. This is a posterior view of the midbrain, sort of in the brain lab. If you pull the cerebrum up and you pull the brainstem down very carefully, you can expose the top or the roof of the midbrain. And this is called the tectum. Tectum does mean the top or the roof of something, and it is the top or the roof of the midbrain. But in strict anatomical position, you need to know that the tectum is on the posterior surface of the midbrain. It is four rounded elevations of gray matter, four little lumpy bumpies that sit on the top, or really the back surface of the midbrain. Those bumps are the superior and inferior colliculi. Colliculi just means little hill. So there's two little hills on the top and two little hills on the bottom. We'll look at them separately. First, the superior colliculi, the two lumps of gray matter on the top. You might have seen them in lab, but what's their purpose? They help regulate eye movements like tracking and scanning and visual reflexes. Example, when you see a flash of lightning, did you ever notice you automatically turn your head, your eyes, your neck in the direction of that light? What made you do that? Something made you do it. It was these two little lumps called the superior colliculi that made you turn your head to the flash of light. I remember superior colliculi with an S, superior R for sight reflexes. Then comes the inferior colliculi, these two little lumpy bumpies down below. These are lumps of gray matter, nuclei, nerve cells that have a mission. Their job is they're part of the hearing or the auditory pathway. They are responsible for some of our auditory reflexes. Example, you hear that familiar crunching of metal from a car accident. Don't you find yourself turning your head in that direction of that sound? That happens automatically as a reflex through those little bumps we call the inferior colliculi. If I, boom, smack my hand right now and you weren't paying attention and you turn towards that sound on your computer, the inferior colliculi made you do that. The next structure of the midbrain I'd like you to know that you should see in the lab as well are the cerebral peduncles. What do the words mean? Cerebral means brain, ped means foot, uncle means little. That might help a little bit because these kind of are foot-like extensions that come from the cerebrum, axons that come from the cerebrum, then run down the midbrain to our feet and other parts of our body to make them move. So I guess you could think of these as little foot-like extensions of axons from your brain to your feet and other things to make them move. Maybe that's a way the root words can help you. If not, let's break it down over here. Here's our picture. Here are the cerebral peduncles, big, thick white areas on the anterior surface of the midbrain. What are they? These are huge motor tracts, thousands of axons that are taking impulses from the cerebral cortex down to the spinal cord, and from there, of course, they're carried to our body parts to make them move. Big motor tracts. The reticular formation, I love the word reti or retic. Reti means a network. And this does help me because as you study the slide and get into the nitty gritty, we'll learn that yes, this really is a network. It's a network both anatomically, a mixture, a network of both motor and sensory neurons, and it's a mixture both of gray matter and white matter. So reticular is a great word for this. It has this appearance on the slide of kind of salt and pepper. And the pepper, the dark stuff, is the gray matter. And the white stuff, the salt, that's the white matter. Those are the white myelinated axons. So it is a mixture, both structurally of white and gray, and functionally of sensory and motor. So I love that term, reticular. So, yes, it is a network of both white myelinated nerve fibers and dark neuron cell bodies, giving it, again, the salt and pepper appearance. It is shown here, and most books do show it here on the cross-section of the midbrain, but you need to know that it passes through the entire brain stem. I got a visual on the next slide to stress that. Yes, it has both sensory and motor functions. Remember, it's a mixture. And it's a cool structure. Look at what it does. It sends sensory impulses up to the brain to help arouse the brain to help maintain consciousness. And it sends motor signals downwards to your muscles to help maintain muscle tone. So one of my favorite questions on the test is, what is the part of the brain specifically that we talked about that helps to keep you awake and aroused and sitting in your chair in class? The best answer would be to pick the reticular formation, because that's exactly what this structure does, and that's what these words say in English. So one year I was given this discussion, and this really smart student in class raised his hand, and he says, okay, smarty pants, Dr. Gonshore, Mr. Know-It-All, what about this disease? And he named it. He says, is this disease, is it caused by problems with the reticular formation? Does anybody know what he said? He was asking me about narcolepsy. He said, is narcolepsy involved in this area here? And I thought to myself, you know what? I really don't know. I never heard that before. That sounds like a good idea. And so I went home and I Googled reticular formation and narcolepsy, and sure enough, I got a bunch of hits. If you don't know what narcolepsy is, that's where people all of a sudden like might be sitting in their chair kind of awake and then all of a sudden fall asleep just like that. And when I read the articles about it, some people have implicated the reticular formation as the problem. And the articles say maybe there's a chemical imbalance of the neurotransmitters in the reticular formation that might lead to the condition called narcolepsy. So I think that's really cool that someone thought about that. And that's how I want you to think. Think outside the box. Again, don't just learn it to learn the pieces, parts. That's a given. Learn it to understand it, synthesize, analyze it, and maybe you'll use it to come up with some new treatment to help people. Here is a nice picture. A sagittal section through the brain. It's a drawing. But this purple kind of cigar-shaped deal, that's the reticular formation. We showed in the midbrain. But look, it extends the entire length of the brain stem. A really cool and really important structure. I love it. Last part of the midbrain I'm going to talk about is called the substantia nigra. if you like your Greek root words, all it means is dark stuff. And yeah, here it is on the picture. I'll put my arrow on it. I got a red box on it too. These are dark because they're darkly pigmented nuclei. Remember, what makes things look dark in the nervous system? Our nerve cell bodies, because they're stuffed with a lot of rough ER. What does the substantia nigra do? You gotta know this. It helps to control subconscious muscle activity. Does that sound familiar? Didn't we already talk about a different part of the brain that controlled basic automatic subconscious muscle movements? We sure did. And this part of the brain called the substantia nigra does work very closely with the basal nuclei. Yes, the basal nuclei and substantia nigra work together very closely. That sounds like a test question, doesn't it? Which two things have this function? Blah, blah, blah. And you'll pick out, hopefully, the basal ganglia and substantia nigra. They help regulate basic automatic subconscious muscle activity. And you got it. People who have Parkinson's disease, do they maybe have problems with the substantia nigra too? And they do. I have autopsy pictures that show in patients with Parkinson's disease, the substantia nigra doesn't even look dark anymore. It turns pale, almost turns white, because they lost a lot of those brain cells in that region. We'll move to the pons next. The pons, remember, when I gave my little visual of me standing up, here it is right here, kind of a roundish structure. I just call it the potbelly pons, but that's not what it's really called. Don't go saying that out in the real world, or they're wondering where you took your anatomy course. People do refer to it, though, as the bridge, and that's a good name because the pons does bridge a lot of other things together that we'll talk about. It is located, yes, inferior to the midbrain, superior to the medulla, and anterior to this package of angel hair pasta that we're really going to call the cerebellum. Remember, just have a pot belly pons and wear a cerebellum backpack, and you'll get this all figured out. The pons, it does really help connect a lot of different parts of the brain together. That's why the bridge is a good nickname. What's inside there? Same old, same old. Here's the general principle. There's tracts in there, and there's nuclei in there. So let's be a little bit more specific. As far as the tracts go, I'm going to take it real easy on you. I'm not going to pick out any named tracts. All I'm going to say is, yep, there's white matter tracts, white myelinated axons that ascend through there with sensory information, and there's some that descend through there with motor information. Where I will get more specific, easy for me to say, is with some nuclei. And I do want you to know that some nuclei are located there inside the pons, which help with breathing. And what if some rocket scientists call the nuclei that help with breathing? They call these the respiratory center. I believe I have a picture of it on the next slide. Here it is. Here's the pons. Here's two little yellow jelly beans. They're not really jelly beans. They're clusters of nerve cell bodies that have a common mission. And the mission is breathing. And this is one of our respiratory centers. Therefore, you will see patients with mini strokes the size of a pea. And if they have a mini stroke in their pons the size of a pea, and if it wipes out one of those little breathing jelly beans, they can suddenly die from a brainstem stroke of the pons. That's why when you see on the chart brainstem stroke, everyone gets really nervous, because they know a lot of our vital centers are located inside the brainstem. We'll wrap up the brainstem with the medulla. The medulla shown here in the drawing, yes, it does extend from the pons to the foramen magnum. That's an important landmark, by the way, that big hole in your head. It forms the inferior part of the brain stem and is continuous with the superior part of the spinal cord. It's a really important landmark to know that the medulla ends at the foramen magnum, where it connects up with the spinal cord. Very important anatomy there. Unfortunately, you'll see patients with severe head and neck injuries. If you recall some of your bony anatomy, you remember the atlas and the axis. Sometimes the neck gets snapped there, and the dens, remember that projection off the axis, will sometimes poke into and puncture the medulla and cause sudden death that way because of the vital centers that we'll learn that are located in the medulla. So again, what's inside the medulla? Well, both tracts and nuclei. So I'm going to pick a tract, pick some nuclei, and we're going to learn the names and function of them. This shouldn't surprise you. This first bullet point says, the medulla contains all the sensory and motor tracts that extend between the spinal cord and other parts of the brain. Well, yeah, it kind of has to. I mean, if between the spinal cord and the brain is the medulla, everything going back and forth between the spinal cord and any other part of the brain must pass through the medulla. It just has to if you know your basic anatomy. The only tracts I'm going to pick out, you got to know specifically by name, are something called the pyramids. The pyramids are shown here in bright yellow on the anterior surface of the medulla. These are large motor tracts. Does that sound familiar? Remember when we did the midbrain? On the front of the midbrain, we had these huge motor cables, white myelinated axons, motor tracts heading down their anterior surface. Then what happened to them? Well, actually, they got buried deep inside the potbelly ponds where you couldn't really see them anymore. Now they reemerge out of the ponds and we see them again now on the anterior surface of the medulla, which again, when I use my body as an example, on the anterior surface of my legs running down, those are just the same motor tracts. It's just a name change game, really. Now we call them the pyramids on the front of the medulla. Then comes one of my favorite places. Notice that the motor tracts, they cross at an area called the decussation of pyramids. This is where our motor tracts cross. And this finally explains something you already know. Remember, the right brain moves the left side of the body and the left brain moves the right side of the body. How's that happen? Somewhere along the line, something's got to cross. And this is where the crossing takes place on the medulla called the decussation of pyramids. And this is one of the meanings of the term called hemispheric lateralization with triple stars. Hemispheric lateralization means the different hemispheres on each side do different things. One example we just did, right brain controls left body, left brain controls right body. That's one of the meanings of hemispheric lateralization that you should know. I have a good summary slide from your book that shows that. So here's showing the right hemisphere, here's showing the left hemisphere. What are some other meanings of hemispheric lateralization? It means the right brain and left brain also have different missions. I want you to circle over here for the right brain, music, art, and emotion. Because the right brain is really known to be our music, art, and emotion brain. We already talked about it when we talked about the language portions of the brain and the music and emotional parts of the brain. What about the left hemisphere? The left hemisphere, I want you to circle reasoning, which means logic, math, and science. So this is our math, science, and reasoning part of our brain, the left hemisphere. If any of you have ever heard about my drawings in class, you know that I have very little stuff on the right side of my brain. And of course, you heard me try to sing earlier too. So I have almost no right brain. I have a halfway decent left brain. I should be walking around lopsided, I suppose. We're going to finish with the medulla on this slide. I want to pick out a couple of the very important nuclei, nerve cell bodies clustered together with a common mission. There's a nuclei that controls heart rate and blood pressure. And some genius call that the cardiovascular center. The name tells you exactly what it does. The cardiovascular center controls the heart and also controls blood pressure by controlling our blood vessels. Then there's another respiratory center. In the medulla, there's more jelly beans, so to speak, more nuclei that help control our breathing. Which brings me to a potential test question. I could ask you on a test something like this. Your patient just had a mini stroke, which led to sudden respiratory arrest. Which part of the brain stem may have been affected? The pons, the medulla, or both? And the answer is, it could be either one, right? The stroke could either be in the pons or in the medulla because there are breathing centers in both the pons and the medulla. So someone who has a stroke that leads to sudden respiratory arrest, it may be in either the pons or the medulla. What else is in the medulla? Did you ever wonder how all this stuff was controlled, like coughing, sneezing, hiccuping, swallowing, vomiting? All this kind of funky stuff. I mean, what controls it? Well, there's nuclei in the medulla that control all that sort of stuff. I know what you're thinking. I was a student one time, too. I remember getting this lecture in medical school, and my brain was just fried. I heard the lecture. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's a lot of stuff to remember. And I said to myself, I'm going out. So I went out. I went out dancing. And you know how when you're out dancing on the dance floor, the music's really loud, and you sing out loud, and you really don't care how you're singing because the music's so loud nobody can hear you. So I'm out on the dance floor after this lecture, and I'm singing, and the song comes on, and I'm singing the words out loud, and I thought I knew the words. I'm singing a song, and it goes something like this, Funky Call Medulla. And I said, that's it. That's how I'm going to remember how all the funky stuff like coughing, sneezing, hiccuping, swallowing, and vomiting is all controlled by the medulla. So I go to home and tell my roommate, I say, here's my memorization technique. Funky Call Medulla. That's the song. It just nails it all down. And he goes, no. That's not the words to the song. The song is really something like Funky Call Medina or something like that. Anyway, it's an old song. You might never heard of it. But to make a long story short, that's how I remember all the funky stuff is controlled in the medulla. I have an article I usually pass around in class at this point in time. The article is entitled, Man Hiccuping for 2 Years Diagnosed with Brain Tumor. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I'm a doctor and I took a little bit of A&P and I remember kind of this stuff, would I really let somebody hiccup for 2 years before I decide to scan their brain? I mean, I know the hiccuping center is in the medulla. Probably after a few days or a few weeks, if the person doesn't stop hiccuping, I'm going to maybe try to figure it out and use my A&P knowledge. I would have scanned that guy's brain, you know, like 2 years ago. Pictures from your book to help you remember. Visuals are always good. Here's a picture of the medulla. And we have this big purple jelly bean, the nucleus called the cardiovascular center. Then I picked out another picture from your book, a drawing with the medulla with two little yellow jelly beans. These are really nuclei that are more of our respiratory centers. So, yes, we have respiratory centers in the pons and in the medulla. Good stuff to know.